This is a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. Go to allthews.3cr.org.au.
Australian Western Sahara Association is a 3CR supporter.
CR would like to acknowledge the Kulin Nation, true owners, caretakers, and custodians of the land from which we broadcast. 3CR pays respect to elders past and present of the Kulin Nation. We recognize their unceded sovereignty.
This is 3CR Breakfast.
Oh, yeah.
Alternative news, analysis, and current affairs. Monday to Friday, 7 a.m. to 8:30 a.m.
Only double.
Grab your pants.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to 3CR Breakfast. Today's Tuesday, the 11th of November. And yeah, we want to say thank you to the Radioactive Show, 3CR's national program on nuclear peace and energy issues. My name's Fung, and in the studio today we've got Fiza and Elena, and later we'll be joined by Juliet as well. Welcome, everyone.
Well, good morning.
Good morning. How are we going this morning? How was everyone's weekend?
Wet.
Yeah.
Very wet.
Yeah.
Did you ride in today as well?
I did.
Oh, well done.
And it's so cold. It's,
yeah. I can imagine having like the thought of exposed hands and then wind coming against it in this wet weather. It's just,
at every stoplight, I'm like blowing on my fingers. Please warm up for 15 seconds.
I don't know if it's shot to memory. Is it always like this? Is every spring like this? It feels particularly cold.
Yeah, I can't remember, but I would say spring is always a bit unpredictable.
Yes, that's true. Yeah.
So, my thing is, I don't mind the rain so much, but wind makes me feel weird.
Biting cold. I was at the Palestine National Day at Fed Square on Saturday, which was beautiful. And but it was raining the whole time, and coming across the river as well, the wind just up straight. Yeah, Fed Square has like zero shade.
Oh yeah, that would be terrible.
It was like, I was like, this is midwinter. It was like, feels like five, windy, but people was dancing and enjoying the food. It was beautiful.
Yeah, how was it?
Yeah, it was incredible. As usual, incredible food, incredible energy, a lot of musicians, a lot of Palestinian talents this time around. Last year we was a bit smaller, and this year we actually got quite a few Palestinians from across interstate as well. So we had like performers from Tassie, from Sydney, so that was pretty nice.
Yeah, that's beautiful.
Good.
Well, hopefully the weather starts to clear, but I had a feeling, I looked at the forecast earlier and it's just rain, I think, for the rest of the week. Yep.
Oh, ghastly.
maybe a reprieve tomorrow, Thursday.
Yeah, brief reprieve.
Yeah, 23. This is our new segment of the show.
Yeah. I know, I feel like
about the weather.
Complaining. Yeah, we talk about the weather extensively. It's like a very Melbourne trait, though, isn't it?
But I feel like when you wake up and you're out at around, you know, we have to get up at like 5:36. Like, that's the first thing you notice.
So. Exactly.
It's so cold.
Yes.
It's freezing.
We promise we'll talk about other things next week.
Yes, we'll find new topics.
okay, let's have a chat about what is coming up on today's show. We're starting today's program by talking to Bonnie Dukakis, who is a Gundindjmara woman and is also CEO of Koori Youth Council. And she'll be on the show to talk to us about the Victorian government's recent decision to reopen the Malmesbury Youth Justice Centre in April 2026 and what that will mean for young people, but especially for young Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people. Then at 7:30, we'll be joined again by Lucinda Thorpe, privacy campaigner at Digital Rights Watch. And this time she'll be discussing the upcoming social media ban, but more specifically looking into age assurance technology, how that will work, what we currently know about it, what we don't know, and the risks for our privacy.
And at 7:45, we'll be speaking to Jenny Ersek, a public housing advocate and activist, as well as former resident of the Barak Beacon Residences in Port Melbourne. Jenny will be chatting about an upcoming documentary, Bayviews for All, which will be coming out on November 26th. And then at 8 o'clock, we'll be having a chat with Christy O'Connell from the Anti-Poverty Centre. Last week, the Social Services Minister tabled a bill to cut Centrelink payments to people accused of serious crimes. And this was passed by the House of Representatives. So Kirsten will be joining us to discuss that.
And finally, on today's show, we'll be listening to an excerpt of yesterday's episode of Women on the Line, where Cleese spoke to Brianna Hammond, who is president of Q-Trans, about the ban on accessing puberty blockers and hormone treatment for new adolescent patients in the public health system in Queensland. So that will be coming up at 8:15. So it's going to be a massive show today. So stay tuned. We'll be back with the news headlines in just a moment.
Some folks know about it, some don't. Some will learn to shout it, some won't. But sooner or later, baby, here's a ditty. Say you're gonna have to get right down to the real nitty-gritty. Let's get right down to the real nitty-gritty. Now, one, two, nitty-gritty. Now, yeah, boom, nitty-gritty.
Bonnie Dukakis is a Gundij Mara woman.
Sorry, we're going to go into the news headlines first. Over to you, Fiza.
Thank you. These are the news headlines for Tuesday, 11th November 2025. Wurundjeri Woi Wurrung people have lodged a native title claim, which will be the seventh native title application Victoria presented to the federal court. It comes as historic treaty legislation is set to be signed into law this week, Victoria being the first state in Australia to pass a treaty with Indigenous people. This claim, filed on Friday by 11 members of the group, extends from the mouth of the Werribee River north to its headwaters in the Great Dividing Range, reaching east to Mount Bobo, south through Bunyip, and west to Mordialloc Creek. This claim also includes the historic Korandak Mission, secured by Wurundjeri leader William Barak, and covers major sections of Victoria's key waterways, including parts of the Yarra River, Plenty, and Maribyrnong Rivers, as well as an area of Port Phillip Bay. If successful, it would become the third native title determination encompassing a capital city after Perth and Adelaide. Filing the application with the federal court is an early step in what can be often a decades-long process. If native title were granted, it would recognise the Wurundjeri Woi Wurrung's right to access, use and protect land in line with their laws and customs, along with the right to be consulted. Native title is only applied to Crown land and does not affect private homes, businesses or public infrastructure. Also in the news, in Sydney, two female MPs have reported receiving dangerous threats following their condemnation of the neo-Nazi rally outside of New South Wales Parliament. Federal MP Allegra Spender and State MP Kelly Sloan reported threats on their life and through rhetorically rape the two women. The New South Wales Premier Chris Minns and Police Commissioner Mel Lanyon spoke to the press on Monday but were unable to respond regarding where the responsibility lay for allowing the rally to have clearance. Lanyon stated that the protest proceeded due to an internal communication error. The Premier also rejected the claim by pro-Palestine activists that the authorisation showed a double standard in New South Wales police's approach to protests. Speaking on ABC Radio on Monday morning, Sloan, the New South Wales Shadow Health Minister and member for Vaucluse, said she received dozens of pretty hateful messages on X on Sunday. Some of the messages, which Guardian Australia understands includes death threats, were concerning enough to forward to police, she said. Sloan has since deactivated her account. Saturday's event followed a rally by the same group outside Parliament in June, which was yet again authorised by police. The permit was lodged under White Australia and related to current immigration levels and the cost of living crisis.
In other news, Richards from the Asbestos Education Committee has revealed that home renovations cause half of all deaths from mesothelioma, a cancer commonly caused by asbestos poisoning. Each year, 4,000 people die from diseases related to asbestos exposure in Australia, a figure three times higher than the national road toll in 2024. One in three homes in Australia contain asbestos. Any home built before 1990 will contain asbestos in some form. More than 60% of DIY home renovators will be exposed to asbestos fibers during renovations. Spokesperson for the national campaign, Sherry Barber, points out that there's no known safe level of exposure exposure to asbestos fibers, but there are tools and rules homeowners and tradies should follow to ensure ACMs are managed safely to protect themselves and their loved ones. Campaign Chair Claire Collins highlights the tragic causes of relatively young people being diagnosed with mesothelioma continue to be recorded because of the exposure to fibers as children when their parents built homes using ACMs unaware of the risks. Finally, in the headlines, according to a testimony made for the TV documentary Breaking Ranks, Inside Israel's War, Israeli soldiers have described a free-for-all in Gaza and a breakdown of norms and legal constraints, with civilians killed at the whim of individual officers. If you want to shoot without restraint, you can. A quote from Daniel, the commander of an Israeli Defense Forces tank unit, says in the documentary broadcast in the UK on ITV on Monday evening. Soldiers who have agreed to speak on the matter have confirmed the use of human shields, contradicting official denials, and gave the details of Israeli troops opening fire unprovoked on the civilians racing to reach food handouts, and the militarized distribution points set up by the U.S. and Israeli-backed Gaza Humanitarian Foundation. A soldier, only identified in the documentary as Eli, says if they're walking too fast, they're suspicious. If they're walking too slow, they're suspicious. Some of the soldiers interviewed in the Breaking Ranks program said that they were influenced by the language of Israeli politicians and religious leaders, suggesting that after the Hamas attack on the 7th of October in 2023, which was about 1,200 Israelis and foreign nationals were killed, every Palestinian was a legitimate target. Breaking Ranks shows the mental strain on at least some of the soldiers in Gaza. I feel like they've destroyed all of my pride in being an Israeli, in being an IDF officer. Daniel, the commander of an Israeli Defense Force, says in the program, all that's left is shame. These have been the news headlines for Tuesday, the 11th of November in 2025. You're listening to 3CR Breakfast on 855 AM.
3CR would like to thank our sponsors, Earth Greetings. Cards that connect, care, and celebrate. Support wildlife and habitat with every purchase. Inspired by nature, giving back to the planet. Learn more at earthgreetings.com.au.
Women on the Line, a radical intersectional current affairs program.
Making space for the voices of women and gender diverse people.
Featuring in-depth conversations with guests from so-called Australia and beyond.
Ultimately, we're looking to care for country, to continue our culture, to continue our ceremonies, so that our children have a strong sense of self and belonging.
Just because our marginalisation intersect where we're both disabled, it doesn't change your white privilege. It doesn't change your straight privilege. It doesn't change your able-bodied privilege.
Sex work, the word itself, has been such a word with a lot of stigma. However, we cannot ignore that there are women out there who are making their livelihood out of this job.
Listen every Monday morning at 8:30 on 3CR Community Radio, 855 AM, or stream live on 3cr.org.au.
Love podcasts? We've got you. Find Women on the Line via the Community Radio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Women on the Line, where about?
Feminisms in their multitudes.
First Nations sovereignty.
Land back.
Trans liberation. Poo-poo on the turfs.
Abolition.
Anti-racism.
Sex worker rights.
South liberation.
Disability justice.
Anti-imperialism.
Decolonisation.
An end to borders.
Workers' justice.
And so much more.
Women on the Line, broadcasting on the 3CR airwaves since 1986.
Woo! Woo!
Fire! Brr. Hi, this is Shirley Hood. You're invited to the 2025 Beyond the Bars CD launch on Thursday, the 20th of November at the Deering Centre next to Collingwood Town Hall. Put it in your diaries. I'll be there as MC for an evening of talks and music, including a panel discussion with some of our deadly broadcasters and music with Mr. Bar Willoughby. Thursday, the 20th of November, the Deering Centre, next to Collingwood Town Hall, 6:30 to 8:30 p.m. Free CDs, snacks and drinks provided. All welcome. See you there. Brrr.
Hi, my name is Miss Kinana. I'm a proud Yorta Yorta, Jar Jar Rong, Kalkadoon and Yirrindali Aboriginal Sovereign Woman. And you're listening to 3CR, guys. Check in with your friends. Make sure you guys are going good. And also stick up for what's right, yeah? Free Palestine.
You're listening to Tuesday Breakfast on 3CR Community Radio, 855 AM, 3CR Digital and 3cr.org.au. We are now joined on the phone by Bonnie Dukakis, who is a Gunditjmara woman and is also CEO of Koori Youth Council, which is the representative body for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander young people in Victoria. Guided by an executive of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander young people, KYC values the diversity and strength of young people as decision makers. The council advocates to government and community to advance the rights and representation of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander young people. And Bonnie joins us on the program this morning to discuss the Victorian government's recent announcement that it will reopen the Malmesbury Youth Justice Centre in April 2026. Good morning, Bonnie.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Thanks so much for joining us this morning. Just quickly, I know I gave a quick summary of what the Koori Youth Council does, but I was wondering if you could also introduce us to KYC in your own words.
Thank you. So Koori Youth Council is a representative body for the voice and aspirations of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander young people living in Victoria. We do that in the policy and advocacy sphere, so we listen to the voices of young people and represent and reflect that back to key decision makers, whether that's state government, whether that's our Aboriginal community-controlled organisations, whether that could be also the youth sector. And we do that and have been doing that for over 20 years, and we're guided by strong community leaders as well through our work.
Yeah, great. Thanks so much for that. So it was announced on Tuesday, the 28th of October, that the Victorian government would be reopening the Malmesbury Youth Justice Centre in April 2026. And this is after the fact that the facility has been closed for the past 2 years. So I was wondering if you could explain to us what was reported in terms of the decision to reopen this facility and the reaction from Koori Youth Council when you found out about this?
It was quite shocking when we first were notified, I think, in terms of there's been strong advocacy around the closure of more prisons rather than the reopening. And in terms of that, there's been a lot of work as well with Aboriginal community leaders and organisations around how can we decolonise a place like Malmesbury that has caused a lot of harm for Aboriginal community over the years, and think about how we can repurpose and redesign into a place of healing and connection for our communities.
Yeah, it seems to go against so much of what has been said from the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander community for years now, but seems to be a trend among state and territory governments. Like we're seeing, this happen in Queensland and Northern Territory as well, in terms of looking to incarceration as a response to, issues concerning young people. So I was wondering if you could talk more about that in terms of the response from the government and how that is at odds with what the community are advocating for.
I think for decades, like, community have called for the need for community-led, culturally safe services and responses. And when we look at our young people that do end up in systems and in prisons, it's around how we can support them to truly heal, to reintegrate back into community. And that could be through support through not just the young person, but also their family and community. When we look at the need of having a blanket response that locking up more children will resolve the issues, we're putting a lot more strain on the system that isn't achieving what it needs to do at the moment. So if we're thinking about the safety and well-being of our children, we need to actually act on that, and we need to make sure that they feel safe and supported and have access to the needs and supports, whether that's could be cultural needs, it could be the specific needs around AOD support, mental health, and making sure that they're accessible in the communities that they live in.
Mm. Yeah, definitely. And can you tell us about the you know, Victoria's latest bail laws and how that has had an impact on Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander young people?
We're seeing quite a stark number of more young people coming into the system. A number of years ago, we were starting to see a decline of young people, which is the goal and aspirations of what we want to see. And that's not because that there's more young people that are, I guess, coming to the attention, but it's around the need for them to be responded to appropriately. And that locking someone up and remanding, the numbers of young people on remand has gone up immensely through this. And that means we've got a number of young people sitting there on remand that haven't yet been sentenced for their offending and what the alleged crimes are, but it's around limited, less access to supports and priority to supports because they're not yet sentenced.
Mm. And, you know, we're seeing in terms of the cost of the ongoing over-reliance on prisons, we're seeing that, you know, locking up a child for one day could cost over $5,000, according to reported costs. And with the facility opening up again in April 2026, it's looking to cost approximately $141 million over 5 years. So, yeah, what are your thoughts and reflections on, in terms of, like, the money that's being invested into these so-called solutions, and where the money could be better spent when it comes to looking after and caring for young people?
I think that speaks for itself in terms of the investment and response, in where a lot of the community responses ask for a portion of that to run programs that would last a lot longer and have stronger impacts, backed by evidence and research as well. So one of our calls through our Nugaji report, which is Hear Me in Woiwurrung language, we did that back in 2018 and we spoke to 42 young people who had currently and previously been in the system. Even though it's quite outdated now in terms of time, the asks and what we looked at in that report are still quite relevant today. And we talk around the investment in local communities to respond to what they need. How do we provide the mechanisms around that to build up their capacity and understanding and support young people to participate and have their voices heard through that process as well?
Mm. When we think about, you know, events that have just happened in our state, including treaty that was passed last week, has there been any... Has the Victorian government reached out to the Koori Youth Council to look into long-lasting, culturally safe supports for young people? Was there any, did they reach out at all when it came to this announcement? Or, yeah, what has the communication been like there?
We've got some coming up this week. We actually have the privilege of sitting on the Aboriginal Justice Caucus. So in Victoria, we actually have the longest standing agreement with Aboriginal community and governments in the country. And I think we've got the forum coming up this week, and this will be a key part of the discussion around what we want to see in terms of better outcomes, better communication and better responses for our communities.
Yeah, so it seems like this is an ongoing discussion, and it'll be interesting to see what the government's response is and what is needed going forward. Is there anything else that you wanted to comment on with the recent announcement of Malmesbury reopening?
I think it's how we can use this as an opportunity to partner with our communities and really and truly listen to what the needs are, and how we, community, know how we best support our young people, and being able to have the opportunity to look at how that can be done differently, I think is the way that we can move forward.
Mm. Yeah, definitely. Well, thank you so much for joining us on the program this morning, Bonnie. I think this is an ongoing conversation. We'd love to have you back on the show again to for any updates regarding this issue, because like we were talking about before, there seem to be trends happening across different states in terms of tightening using prisons and using incarceration as a first response to issues. But really, we know, like you said, it needs to be, well, it just needs to not exist, really, and for there to be more radical ways of looking after young people.
Yeah, definitely. Thank you.
Thank you so much. We'll speak to you soon.
Thank you. Bye.
We've been speaking to Bonnie Dukakis, who is a Gundudjmara woman and is the CEO of Koori Youth Council. To find out more, you can head to www.kooriyouthcouncil.org.au, and you can also find out more about the impacts of Victoria's dangerous bail laws on Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander communities by following the work of the Victorian Aboriginal Legal Service. We are going to go to a song now, so I'm just going to ask Elena to introduce it.
This next song will be by Sampa the Great, who is a Zambian-born rapper and singer who has become a major force in Australian music. This is their song, Final Form.
It's the government's job to protect Australia's forests and oceans, but too often, governments put the interests of big corporations ahead of protecting your health, your climate, and your children's future. The Albanese government is about to change Australia's nature law. While this might seem like telling them how to suck eggs, we expect laws that actually protect nature by closing deforestation loopholes and protecting threatened species. It's literally their job. Head to wilderness.org.au/suckeggs to learn more. The Wilderness Society is a 3CR supporter.
You're listening to 3CR Tuesday Breakfast, and before those messages, we were listening to Final Form by Sampa the Great. We're now joined once again by Lucinda Thorpe, privacy campaigner at Digital Rights Watch, and she joins us on the show again to talk about the upcoming social media ban due to come into effect next month. But more specifically, we'll be discussing age assurance technology, what we currently know and don't know, and the privacy risks involved in engaging with this type of technology. Welcome back to the program, Lucinda.
Hi, thanks so much for having me on.
Thanks again for being on our show. So as I was preparing these questions, I remember messaging you being like, I have no idea about age assurance technology at all. So I was wondering if you could start by explaining what that is and how it works.
Yeah, absolutely. So as the under 16 social media ban rolls out, platforms are going to have to use these age assurance technologies to verify that a user is over 16. And there are several different approved methods that they might use. And there's kind of problems unique to each of them. So the first is providing a government-issued document, including maybe even digital ID, and basically handing that over to the site. The obvious problem with this one is that it's pretty easy to acquire the documents of, say, an older sibling or even a parent, and they don't really have a way to verify that it's you. The second option is facial recognition and age estimation, and this is where you allow the platform to scan your face and then estimate your age. So age estimation systems are really, really unreliable. A lot like facial recognition technology, it's particularly unreliable for women, children, and people of colour. The recent age verification trial found that these errors are inevitable, especially for people close to the age threshold, like 14 to 17, which means it's going to be pretty unreliable for the people who are using this the most. Now, even a small error rate when applied across all of Australia will affect thousands of people who are likely to be of colour, women and children. If you are worried about being misidentified as under 16 and losing access to your social media, you'll be interested to know that actually a quick trip to the $2 store could save your account. So old man masks and those fake glasses with the eyebrows and the moustaches actually work the majority of the time to get past this technology, to give you an idea of what we're dealing with here. The next option is credit card checks. They assume that everyone over the age of 16 has a credit card and everyone under the age of 16 does not have access to one. Also available is the parental consent option. This is a really bizarre one to me because if you're under 16, it doesn't matter if you have parental consent or not. So it's really just parental consent for 16 and 17-year-olds. So it's a really narrow window of use. But this one is so flawed because you've got no way of verifying if the person providing parental consent is actually a legal guardian. Mm-hmm. They have no way of knowing that. And a lot of the time, these systems won't necessarily account for different family dynamics as well. So like step-parents, or if you have maybe like two mums, or you're in like foster care, if you're in residential care, they don't really allow for those dynamics. And that's something that the report acknowledges. All of these options are pretty flawed thus far, but I actually think the most concerning one is this last one, and that's AI-driven profiling. And AI profiling collects really granular data on each user and then attempts to infer their age. Now, this would be problematic even if it were correct. But reality is they're very error prone and they're very context blind. So if you're an adult who frequently consumes child-oriented content like animated films, you could be misclassified as a child.
Wow, thank you so much for that very detailed summary of all the different technologies out there. It seems on the surface that there are issues with all of them. Do we know if is the government going to be choosing what technologies are being used, or is that dependent on each social media platform? Because mm-hmm. it just seems like there are so many different ways to go about it. It's very confusing.
It is really confusing. You're 100% right. And this is something that a lot of the social media platforms have been kind of struggling with as well. But what we can expect is a layered approach. So the different social medias are going to have to apply at least one of these, but they can't only use submitting government-issued documents. They need to have another option as well. And the recommendation is they have multiple because the government recognises that they're all quite flawed. So maybe not all of them would work for everyone.
Yeah, and there's something sort of scary about that, you know, like having to engage with more or multiple of these technologies in order to prove your age. It just seems like with each layer of age assurance technology, there's like more and more data handed over to these tech companies and social media platforms. And I know you've spoken to us before about privacy issues around, you know, like facial recognition, biometric data and things like that. So I was wondering if you could talk more about the impacts on our privacy, not just for young people, but I guess for all of us or anyone who's going to have to encounter this technology.
Yeah, absolutely. So each of the methods have kind of their own unique concerns. For example, with AI-driven profiling, the approach incentivizes the collection of really granular personal data. It requires the entity to already have that data stored in its database so that it can go to it and kind of look at that data and say, oh, this person is acting like a 14-year-old or an 18-year-old or a 68-year-old. And this provides the entities with a legally grounded excuse to surveil users and collect and store this personal data. And there's no legal requirement for this data to be extra protected or only be used for age verification purposes, meaning it's vulnerable to data breaches, and you could technically have it be used to directly target you with ads, which isn't great. AI facial estimation also, age estimation, also has some really serious privacy problems. So the restricted sites such as, for example, porn sites, because it's not just the social media that it's getting banned. There's also a bit happening online as well with Google. And they'll be handling sensitive biometric data without the guarantee of guardrails as to the deletion, use, retention or protection of this data. And the Australian sites will only have to apply the Australian privacy principles if they generate over $3 million in revenue a year. So if the data is stored in like overseas areas, they may be able to access really incredibly sensitive data regarding Australians. So that's another concern. And biometric data, once it's compromised, you can't, you know, get a new security token. Like, that's your face. It's gone, like, in terms of privacy. It's out there. Another really massive concern is the normalization of providing really sensitive information to prove your age. So if credit card checks become commonplace, it'll be easier for scammers to make fraudulent requests for credit card information, creating new opportunities for scams, fraud and exploitation. And it's the same with photo ID. So we actually think that this kind of massive uploading of photo ID and that becoming really normal will lead to a proliferation of identity theft. It'll kind of set up a really nice trap for Australians. it's kind of setting us up for failure a little bit.
Yeah, that's just so much data that we're handing over. And I think that that's what's scary is the normalization of it. And how much, how many different forms of data that is going to be required. So not just credit card numbers, but your face, personal details, who your parents or guardians are. There's just a lot of personal information that's going out there. Unfortunately, we're running out of time, Lucinda, but just wanted to end on any reflections you have in terms of how the social media ban is going to alter the way that people navigate online spaces, taking into consideration this age assurance technology, but also just, the handing over of private details. Do you foresee ways in which, online or how we act online will change in the near future?
I think how individuals act online, it's such a globalised space. Australians only make up, a fraction of online users. So I don't think the fabric of social media will be altered internationally. I think probably the biggest difference will be the level of care that social medias take. And that's because they have the argument now that, the kids aren't on here. So why should I have to moderate as closely? Why should I have to control hate speech or misinformation as closely? Because it's only really supposed to be adults that are on here. So I think Australians can expect to maybe receive a slightly decreased duty of care compared to maybe other countries which do have kids on their social media.
Yeah, that's a really interesting point and something that I'd love to get into, but unfortunately we're out of time today. But thanks so much again, Lucinda, for joining us on the program to try and unpack some of this technology for us. Looking forward to speaking with you again in a couple of weeks.
Absolutely, my pleasure.
So we've been speaking to Lucinda Thorpe, who is privacy campaigner at Digital Rights Watch. Stay tuned because in a couple of weeks, Lucinda will be back on the show to discuss the ways in which women and girls are experiencing violence online as part of the 16 days of activism to end gender-based violence under the theme Unite to End Digital Violence Against All Women and Girls. We are going to go to another track now. We're going to go to another song. This one is by Fairtrade Narcotics. Cerulean is a song featured on a self-titled album by them. They are a psychedelic jazz group based in Nam.
Brr. Hi, this is Shirley Hood. You're invited to the 2025 Beyond the Bars CD launch on Thursday, the 20th of November at the Deering Centre next to Collingwood Town Hall. Put it in your diaries. I'll be there as MC for an evening of talks and music, including a panel discussion with some of our deadly broadcasters and music with Mr. Bar Willoughby. Thursday, the 20th of November, the Deering Centre, next to Collingwood Town Hall, 6:30 to 8:30pm. Free CDs, snacks and drinks provided. All welcome. See you there. Brrr.
Jeannie Ersek is a public housing advocate and activist and former resident of the Burrock Beacon Residences in Port Melbourne. And Jeannie's here today to chat about her experience in public housing and the need to protect and defend public housing. And we'll also be chatting about an upcoming documentary, Bay Views for All, which is out later this month. Welcome to Tuesday Breakfast, Jeannie.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Well, thank you so much for coming on. To start off, could you tell our listeners a little bit about yourself and, your experience in public housing?
Well, I have lived in public housing for the past 30 years. I originally lived at the Bank Street Estate, which was all public housing for 24 years. That was demolished, and so I then was moved to Port Melbourne at the Barrett Beacon Estate. I was only there 2 years when I found out it was going to be demolished again to make way for private and community housing. And then I got moved to another house in Port Melbourne.
Yeah, well, it sounds like there's been, unfortunately for you, Jeannie, a lot of moving around. And, I think, you know, that sounds, you know, like a lot of stories we've heard about public housing across the city where, you know, they are, demolishing public housing in favour of building private developments, and as well as, yeah, as you're saying, this so-called community housing. But can you start off by telling us a bit about, the Burrock Beacon community and what the public housing was like there?
Well, I was only there 4 years, unfortunately, but it was a wonderful community. I lived just across the road from the beach, so I had the view of the ocean. You could hear the ocean. But it was a great community. There were only 89 units. I knew all my neighbours along the boulevard. That's where I lived. But it was very welcoming. There were no disturbances. My neighbour used to help me out when I had a parcel that I had to collect at the post office. I didn't have a car. He willingly took me. The neighbours were very willing to help you out with anything you wanted.
Yeah, that sounds like a really, tight-knit and, wonderful community, Jeannie. And I know that, back in 2021, the government announced that they were going to demolish the public housing. Could you talk us through, the story of what happened there, and was it quite a sudden announcement?
Yes, it was only 13 days before Christmas in 2021 they had come to the door and said that we had to be relocated because the estate was going to be demolished. And that's when I asked them, well, I'd only been there 2 years. Surely if they knew it was going to be demolished, why would they have sent me there to live? And they said they didn't know anything about that. And I said, well, what about community consultation? They didn't know anything about that either. And they didn't know anything about anything, really. All the fact was that I had to move.
That seems like, a very strange decision that, you'd only been there for a couple of years and they didn't know that in advance. It seems like there wasn't a lot of forward planning when it went to organising your housing. And then, so after that, the estate was demolished and then you had to move on. And I'm sure that, many other people also, faced a lot of challenges in that demolition. Can you tell us about how some of those stories are coming together in the documentary?
Yes, so in the documentary it focuses on a few people who were the last residents left. I mean, Margaret Kelly was the final resident. She refused to go, so they took her to VCAT, and so she was forcibly removed in August 2 years ago. But there are other residents there that were forced to go as well. they weren't taken to VCAT, but they were made to move. Margaret had two elderly neighbours. One had had a stroke. The other one was very sick and old. And they had to move. They really had no consideration for them.
Mm, yeah, it sounds like, yeah, very difficult, especially, yeah, for her neighbours who were very elderly to have to move, yeah, very suddenly and without much warning. What in terms of the documentary, you know, I'm sure it tells a lot of different stories of the residents of Burke Beacon. What do you think that kind of the overall message of the documentary is? What can our listeners kind of learn from that documentary?
These are people's homes. They're not just houses that we shouldn't expect just a knock at the door to say that our place is going to be demolished. At least have some community consultation. And if they are to be demolished, at least replace them with public housing and not private housing and community housing.
It really seems like, you know, in this situation, particularly I know the title of the documentary is Bay Views for All. So I guess, there was really this idea that, you can let me know if this is right or not, Jeannie, but that was really prime real estate and perhaps the government, you know, wanted to profit off that, particular location.
Oh, absolutely. I think so. Because, I mean, my unit faced overlooked the beach, so I could see the beach and I could hear the waves at night. So it was just prime real estate. But I mean, some local people still had the view of the developers that we shouldn't be here, because when it went online that it was going to be redeveloped there, some people had said, well, you shouldn't be living there in the first place.
Yeah, that's just ridiculous. I feel like, you know, anyone should be able to live, in that location. That seems, very, kind of unfair discourse about, you know, who deserves to live where. That's,
Yes, well, when I lived at Paran, my first offer was the unit at Burke Beacon. I didn't ask to live at Port Melbourne and I didn't ask to live across the road from the beach. I just asked for a 3-bedroom unit and that's what I was offered and that's what I accepted.
Mm. Yeah, well, I think, it really goes to show that, with public housing, you're not the one who's deciding exactly, you know, where the public housing is built or where you're going to live. And, then you've got a lot of angry people in other parts of the community who don't really understand that and, you know, have these expectations of how the land should be used. In thinking about, I know at the moment there's, the big threat of a lot more public housing being demolished in Melbourne. What are your thoughts on all of this?
They should not be demolished and that they should be redeveloped. I mean, there are so many people on the waiting list. It isn't going to help. And the buildings could be retrofitted and they could save the government millions of dollars, but they have chosen to go through the route of demolishing them all and then having private apartments built and community housing built and no public housing.
Yeah, and for people who might not know, what is the difference between public and community housing?
Public housing is housing owned by the government. The rent, your rent is set at 25% of your income, and basically you can really have it for life. Community housing is run by a not-for-profit company. The rent is sometimes 30%, sometimes higher. You don't have the stability of being able to stay there as long as you can. It's very up in the air as to what your situation is.
It really seems like, they're really not very comparable. And, as you said, public housing is a lot more stable and long-term, whereas community housing is a much more short-term solution for housing. That isn't giving people that security that they need. Before we finish up, Jeannie, would you be able to point to where our listeners can go, perhaps to if they want to find out more or watch the documentary?
They can go to barrettbeacon.com and the site will list the film that is showing, The Bay Views for All, on Wednesday the 26th of November.
Yeah, fantastic. Well, we definitely encourage people to go and watch the documentary so they can, you know, find out more about the stories of the Barrack Beacon residents and the story of that redevelopment and how it really impacted the community. But yeah, thank you so much for joining us. We really appreciate you coming on and telling us your story.
Thank you for having me.
Of course. Well, we've been chatting to Jeannie, who's a public housing advocate and former resident at the Barrack Beacon Public Housing, talking about the fight to defend public housing in Port Melbourne and the upcoming documentary Bay Views for All. And you can find out more at barrackbeacon.com and attend the screening on Wednesday, 26th of November at RMIT Khalid Theatre. And up next, we're going to listen to a song. This is Christine Anu with her song Island Home. You're listening to Tuesday Breakfast, and that was Island Home by Christine Anu. And Up next, we're going to be chatting to Kristen O'Connell from the Anti-Poverty Centre. And last week, the Social Services Minister, Tanya Plibersek, put forward a bill to cut Centrelink payments to people accused of serious crimes, which has now been passed by the House of Representatives, but is still up for debate in the Senate. And Kristen joins us today to discuss concerns about this bill and how it could breach the right to social security and the disproportionate impact it could have on marginalised communities. Welcome back to 3CR, Kristen.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, thank you so much for coming on. So, Kristen, could you start off by telling us a bit about this bill that was introduced to Parliament last week?
Yeah, I'm going to go back one step because it is a bit confusing. We had earlier this year, the government lost a court case that meant they had unlawfully calculated millions of Centrelink debt. Their response to that was to rush a bill into Parliament that retrospectively legalises those millions of unlawful Centrelink debts and makes really small payments to people who receive one. They're calling them a resolution payment, and it's sort of supposed to be like compensation, but say you had a $15,000 debt, the maximum payment you'll receive is $600. That you think, well, what the hell is that about? That's not about what this is, right? And it's not. That bill went to an inquiry, got scrutinised by the Senate Community Affairs Legislation Committee, the Parliamentary Joint Committee on Human Rights, and the Senate Bill Scrutiny Committee. They all completed their reports, and then a couple of weeks later, Tanya Plibersek, on the third reading in the House, so right at the last minute, introduced this completely unrelated amendment, saying that if people are accused of a serious violent or sexual offence and they're receiving a Centrelink payment, that the police and some relevant government ministers will have the power to cancel that person's payment if they haven't been apprehended. And of course, there's a lot of hopefully obvious red flags and problems for your audience, but that's kind of, in a nutshell, what's happened. And there are a variety of rights that are being breached there, whether we're talking about the right to social security, the right to due process, the right to equality under the law. And there have been questions around the constitutionality of it and the separation of powers.
Definitely. And yeah, really, I think what stands out as well is that it's for anyone who's been accused of that serious crime. It's not someone who's actually been convicted. And can you talk a little bit about, Kristen, kind of who's going to be impacted by the bill in terms of who that could encapsulate?
Yeah, I guess there's almost two key groups that we're really concerned about. The first group firstly, I just want to say fundamentally, everyone has a right to social security, no matter what they have done. That is a base expectation in our society. And we removed something called the good character test from social security in 1947. So there's two key groups, I think, where we think of it as unintended consequences or disproportionate harm. One is people who are discriminated against in their own right, so people who are wrongly accused. That obviously includes people who are racialised, particularly First Nations people. It includes disabled people, particularly people with psychosocial disabilities, intellectual disabilities and cognitive disabilities. People who may have really good reasons why they are afraid of the police and therefore what the police would describe as fugitives or absconding are people who are fleeing in the attempt to kind of keep themselves safe from the police themselves. There are also, and so those communities are over-policed and misidentified often as people who have committed one of these offences. We also then have people who are not necessarily being, may have this applied to them because there's disproportionate discrimination, but because they are misidentified as perpetrators. And the key group here is people in violent relationships or homes who may defend themselves against attack. And there have been many inquiries on this continent about the misidentification of women leaving violent partners or living with violent partners, in fact, who have these accusations against them and who may be fleeing that violent home as so at a time when they're actually trying to save their own life and maybe their children's lives, this law could be applied in a way that makes that even more difficult. And we did hear from a woman last week, a really horrific story, who was accused of killing one of her children who had died, took her children from an unsafe foster home and fled to a different state, and took a very long time to have her name fully cleared. And this is the kind of person who could be captured by these laws. Finally, there's people who rely on someone's payment but are not the person who receives the payment or are accused of the crime. And that can include immediate family, but particularly in poor communities and in Aboriginal communities, there are large, complex family ties where you have maybe a large number of people under one roof, and someone's payment is having the rent automatically deducted from it, having the phone bill, the energy bill. And so that payment being cancelled actually may not affect the individual who's accused at all, but may have these ramifications for many other people around them who rely on that payment.
Yeah, definitely. It sounds like, yeah, there's so many different groups who would be impacted. And, yeah, as you're saying as well, Kristen, that it's a lot of people who are already experiencing a lot of disadvantage who would then, you know, have that real hardship of losing their Centrelink payment on top of that. So, yeah, it really sounds like it could have quite disastrous consequences. And unfortunately, yeah, we've sort of seen that the media coverage around this bill has been very critical of opponents to it. But could you talk us through this and break down some of the misconceptions in the media?
Yeah, I would say there has been some excellent work as well, in particular Amy Romekis in the New Daily and at The Point has been really good. But that, yes, you're right, there has been some really abhorrent coverage. And I think what we've seen is so many groups are opposing this amendment to this bill. That includes everyone from organisations who support women experiencing family violence, disability representative organisations, welfare rights organisations. And Tanya Plibersek has gone to the media making comments that essentially imply that our organisations don't take child abuse seriously and don't take sexual violence seriously. And that has really set the tone for the kind of coverage this has received. The ABC ran an article that, you know, included some sort of allusion to that, but also quoted someone from the Police Federation who said, "I don't think people will be wrongly accused." And that was part of his defence of having this.
Oh, my God.
I think the 3CR listeners know that police are unimpeachable and never get it wrong. So I think we all have confidence in what he said there. But the minister then went on to Sky News after really struggling to get, I think, what she wanted the community to hear across through the media. And as I said, made those really revolting comments about our organisations and about MPs who are opposing this. But I would say, you know, the minister is very out of touch with the community. That, again, won't surprise people. But I did go on a conservative talkback radio station last week to talk about this, and their listeners got the issue immediately. There was no confusion as to why this is a horrible overreach, a real terrifying power grab that completely breaches so many of those fundamental rights and structures in the injustice system on this continent.
Yeah, definitely. What do you think, what sort of message do you think the government's trying to send through passing a bill like this?
So, you know, it's been very difficult to get the minister to give any reason for this. And at this point in time, she has not given a justification that there is any imminent threat. She does not say there is anything they are currently wanting to do to protect the community that they can't do. And I think the government is running away from News Corp linking people on Centrelink payments to Desi Freeman. The government has not openly admitted that, but it has been heavily implied, noting that Desi Freeman did have dependents, and so, again, that payment was supporting more than just him. But really, this just seems like an easy win for the government to attack welfare recipients and fuel that anti-welfare rhetoric that Commissioner Holmes identified in the Robert at Royal Commission as being a huge driver of public sentiment towards welfare recipients that enabled Robert to happen. And she called upon politicians to stop engaging in this type of politics.
Mm. Yeah, I think, yeah, unfortunately, you know, as you've just said, Kristen, there's, you know, so much, kind of stigma and, negative views towards welfare recipients and, bills like this aren't helping with that either. Can you talk us through what's going to happen next? Because, the Senate's still debating this bill. What's going to happen, do you think?
That's right. It's hard to know, but we do have Senator Lydia Thorpe, who jumped on this immediately as soon as she became aware of it, who will be moving an amendment to remove this unrelated section of the bill entirely. We know that Senator David Pocock will be seeking to split the bill, so that's a bit of a process issue. They're both going about it with different tactics to try and get this removed in the first instance. But it is unclear. People who are trying to engage with the minister, we are really being met with a stone wall. As I said, we don't know what the government's reason is, and we also don't know what their plan is. So we don't know what's going to happen. The next parliamentary sitting is just 2 weeks away. So we are trying to get as many organisations as possible to stand up and publicly oppose this. As you said, there have been challenges trying to get media coverage. Mm. So we're really relying on the community and civil society organisations to come together over the next 2 weeks and make it impossible for the government to get away with this, because they really were hoping no one would notice, and they were caught off guard when we did.
Yeah, well, wishing you and all the other community orgs all the best trying to challenge this bill and the unintended consequences that it could have. But thank you so much for joining us this morning, Kristen, and explaining and kind of giving us an overview of this quite complicated amendment.
Thanks so much, Oak.
Thank you so much. Well, we've been chatting to Kristen O'Connell from the Anti-Poverty Centre, and we've been talking about a proposed bill that would cut Centrelink payments to people accused of serious crimes. And we've talked about the unintended consequences of that bill and who it could disproportionately impact, including Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander communities and women who are experiencing family violence.
Has Centrelink made a decision you disagree with? Most Centrelink decisions can be appealed up to 3 times. Examples of decisions you can appeal include whether you're eligible for a payment, cancellation or suspension of your payment, how much you get paid, and Centrelink debts. One of the most common Centrelink decisions appealed are Centrelink debts. Centrelink will say you owe a debt if the staff determine you've been paid more than you should have. Debts can occur for a variety of reasons. In some instances, if there's been an administrative error or if you have special circumstances, you may not have to repay that debt. The appeal process is free, but time limits can apply and will affect your entitlement to back payment. Social Security Rights Victoria is a specialist community legal centre providing Victorians free advice to help you understand your Centrelink issues and the appeal processes. You can contact Social Security Rights Victoria on 9481 0355 or online at ssrv.org.au. The Federation of Community Legal Centres is a 3CR supporter.
Up next, we'll be listening to a segment from yesterday's episode of Women on the Line, where Cleese spoke to Brianna Hammond, president of Q-Trans, about the ban on accessing puberty blockers and hormone treatment for new adolescent patients in the public health system in Queensland. In this excerpt, Brianna provides some context for the ban as well as the impact on trans and gender diverse community in Queensland. The conversation first aired on Women on the Line on Monday, the 10th of November, 2025. And if the content in the following conversation is distressing for you or someone you care about, you can reach out to QLife for support on 1-800-184-527 from 3 p.m. to midnight or go to qlife.org/au.
A lot has been happening in Queensland in recent times in relation to the rights of trans and gender diverse young people. That came to a head recently on October 28th, where we saw a lot of things unfold in relation to the ongoing ban put in place by the Queensland state government on puberty blockers and hormone therapies for new adolescent patients. But before we get into the latest events, could you tell us about the ban and how it came to be?
The basis of the ban essentially goes back to the 2023 and 2024 LNP state conventions, where they passed resolutions essentially calling on the Queensland government, or the Queensland LNP government, to ban the provision of any hormone therapies within the Queensland Children's Centre Service. Skip ahead to the 5th of January this year, and we had the Deputy Premier, Joe Blay, make a public announcement that it was the intention of the government to roll back access to services through the Queensland Children's Gender Service, and that culminated in the decision of 28 January that was announced by the Health Minister, where they used the excuse of there was a technical issue with the Cairns clinic to put a halt to all of the provision of children's gender services in terms of hormone therapies, the stage one and stage two, on the basis that there wasn't proper consent. We haven't heard a lot about that since then, but we most certainly have had the Health Minister make it absolutely clear that it was his intention for that not to continue. So it was essentially based in religious and political, without religious and a political framework. It had nothing to do with there being any doubts about the quality of the medicine or the science.
We will touch on this question of evidence-based care in our conversation going forward. So there was a challenge to the ban by the mother of a trans child in the Supreme Court, which culminated on Tuesday, October 28th, when Supreme Court Justice Peter Callaghan ruled that the ban was unlawful. And he did that on the basis that the initial directive issued by Director of Queensland Health, Dr. David Rosengren, was unlawful, as the 22-minute online meeting with health services that was held in relation to the ban did not amount to consultation, which is required in legal terms. So can you tell us a bit more about that and what happened next?
Yeah, well, essentially it's an administrative decision by the minister, and when those decisions are made, they need to pay regard to all parties concerned and ensure that they have the opportunity to put forward whatever information and advice that they'd like to tender. It's not possible within administrative law for the minister just to make a decision without consulting with affected parties. And he did that, and it was quite a abject failure of his duties within that role. So it was always clear it was going to be overturned. What was also similarly obvious was that the minister was going to move to re-implement the ban using either another head of power within the Health Act or provide some form of consultation that was essentially just farcical, to allow him to re-implement that decision, which he has subsequently, within hours of the Supreme Court handing down its overturning of the ban.
Yes, so that is Health Minister Tim Nicholls who, yes, reinstated the freeze there. And, I mean, that is a hugely dramatic turn of events. I mean, even if it sort of was clear that probably the Health Minister would flex those powers. I mean, what has the impact been from this on the trans and gender diverse community in Queensland?
Well, it was another blow, especially to the 491 adolescents who were progressing through the Queensland Children's Gender Service and hoping to get access to those stage one or stage two blockers. There's a lot of dysphoria within that cohort, and that's why they're attending the gender service, hoping to go through the issues with psychologists and the multidisciplinary team that are there, and they work through things with the children and their parents over a period of 12 to 18 months before they get anywhere near the medicine. So there's a lot of psychological work and support work that goes on, trying to ascertain where that person is in life, how strongly they feel about their gender identity, whether that be trans masc, trans femme, non-binary. It's not just a matter of them coming into the clinic and saying, oh, look, I'm trans, I want to go on these blockers, and they give them a card to go out to a vending machine and they're dished out. it's quite a laborious process. But it's a process that creates confidence within those individuals that they've been taken seriously and that their psychological and their medical needs will be addressed. Now, when they implemented that ban, it struck at both those things. It stopped the medication being dispensed for the people that were hoping to get onto them. And psychologically, it just crushed them, because a big issue with young people is that the feeling that they don't want to progress to the development of secondary sex characteristics. And later on in life, things like beards and genitalia cause massive distress, and they're massively expensive to try and correct. Surgeries, you know, can run to hundreds of thousands of dollars for those individuals, as well as the obvious dysphoria that they must experience up until that point. So, yeah, they've lost a lot of confidence in the system, and they're having to deal with that ongoing distress. There are some positives that have come out of it. We've seen a new service pop up in Queensland called Gender Health Australia that is filling the role of the Queensland Gender Service, but in a private practice setting. It's a multidisciplinary team, and they're able to access every bit of service, and probably a little bit more, that the Children's Gender Service were offering, but parents have to pay for it. It's not free, but it's there. So I think that's one positive, that there is now more service out there. But, yeah, the family still has to bear the cost of that in the meantime.
You mentioned earlier that this is sort of a religious and political decision on the part of the Queensland government. There is a lot of discussion from the Queensland government about so-called evidence-based care for young people. Let's talk more about that, and especially this sort of ominous references to quote-unquote scientific evidence coming from overseas. So that, in my understanding, is a reference to the CAS review, which took place in 2024 in the United Kingdom. Could you talk a bit more about the impact of that review how Australian guidelines and systems differ from what's currently taking place in the NHS?
Yeah, well, essentially CAS did not do a review of the medical evidence. They looked at some of the psychological stuff, and then they mistook and misunderstood a lot of the psychological issues associated with that. And as far as Australia is concerned, yes, there is some attempts to import that report to the Australian context. We have our own guidelines in Australia called AusPath. They provide the standards of care that are first class. They're first class in the world in terms of the regimen that has been created for dealing with patients who present to a medical professional and indicate that they're experiencing some type of gender dysphoria, a gender presentation that's inconsistent with the sex they were announced at birth. And, the National Health and Medical Research Council is looking at that issue at the moment in terms of those standards of care. We're extremely confident that they're going to get a very big tick about those standards of care, and hopefully that will set the benchmark for the states to follow. I'm confident that a few states will do that, but the Northern Territory in Queensland, yeah, I'm extremely sceptical.
That was a conversation that Cleese had with Brianna Hammond, president of Q-Trans, for this week's episode of Women on the Line. To listen back to the entire conversation, as well as the interview with Piper Valkyrie from Magandan People's Pride, go to 3cr.org.au/womenontheline.
3CR is about community, and we welcome your participation at the station.
3CR is open to a wide diversity of volunteers and is a great way to connect with Melbourne's activist community.
Have you ever thought about volunteering, doing a reception shift, getting a program on air,
training in radio skills, or contributing to one of the station's committees?
There are many ways to be involved at 3CR.
To find out more, go to 3cr.org.au and get in touch.
The annual Melbourne Pacifica Festival is on again, 10 a.m. to 7 p.m. Saturday, December the 6th, at the playground end of Banjo Paterson Park in Lynbrook. Immerse yourself in the richness of Pacific Island culture with traditional dance, dynamic drumming, soulful harmonies, bands, guest artists, children's activities including rugby clinics, Pacifica arts and crafts, and yummy food. Lots of fun and activities for the whole family. Saturday, December the 6th in Lynbrook. Visit melbournepacificafestival.org. Melbourne Pacifica Festival is a 3CR supporter.
You're listening to Tuesday Breakfast, and before we wrap up, we've got our events calendar for the week. So this Tuesday, the 11th of November, from 6:30 to 8:30 p.m, there's going to be the inaugural Gaetano Greco Memorial Symposium on Gramsci's Contemporary Relevance, and that's going to be taking place, I think, at Trades Hall. And then we've got Thursday the 13th of November at 6:50 is the Palestinian Film Festival, Put Your Soul on Your Hand and Walk, and that's going to take place at Cinema Nova. And then on Saturday the 15th of November at 10 a.m. we've got the Big Ride for Palestine taking place at the Highland Lake Park near the Children's Playground out in Craigieburn. And then finally on Sunday the 16th of November, there's the Run for Palestine, also at 10 a.m. At the Tan Track at Tom's Block in the Royal Botanic Gardens.
Yeah, and so lots to look forward to this week. And that's all we have for today, but massive show. Thank you so much for joining us. We started this morning with a chat with Bonnie Dukakis, a Gundij Mara woman and CEO of Koori Youth Council, speaking about the reopening of the Malmesbury Youth Justice Centre in April 2026 and the concerns, obviously, they have with regards to that. At 7:30, we were joined by Lucinda Thorpe from Digital Rights Watch, discussing the new age assurance technology and how much and or really how little we know about that and the privacy risks involved in engaging with this type of technology.
And then at 7:45, we spoke to Jeannie Ersig, a public housing advocate and activist and former resident of the Burrup Beacon Residences in Port Melbourne. And Jeannie joined us to talk about an upcoming documentary, Bay Views for All, about that the redevelopment of the Burrup Beacon Residences and the broader need to protect and defend public housing. And then at 8 o'clock, we spoke to Kristen O'Connell from the Anti-Poverty Centre, who joined us to chat about the bill that's currently being debated in Parliament to cut Centrelink payments to people accused of serious crimes. And we discussed concerns about this bill and how it could breach the right to social security and the disproportionate impact it would have on Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander communities, as well as women facing domestic violence.
And finally, at 8:15, we listened to an excerpt of yesterday's episode of Women on the Line, where Cleese spoke to Brianna Hammond, the president of Q-Trans, about the ban on accessing puberty blockers and hormone treatment for new adolescent patients in the public health system in Queensland.
And that's all we have for you today. Stay tuned to 3CR. Up next will be Accent of Women.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.